everyone who loves books. This is Read On.
Hello, I'm Nigella Lawson and you're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Season's greetings and welcome to Read On. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we've got a festive feast of book news, reviews and author interviews. Nigella Lawson shares her recipe for serving up success in the kitchen, even if you can't see what you're doing.
The tyranny of the recipe can stop people from enjoying the playful side of cooking.
Sue Moorcroft helps unwrap her new novel, A Christmas Gift.
I'm a bit of a story magnet. As soon as somebody tells me something, I store it away if it's any good. So watch what you tell me, just in case.
And Robert Kirkwood reviews a couple of Christmas crackers from Game of Thrones author G.R.R. Martin.
Aegon Targaryen spurned the Storm King's proposal. He had two wives, he pointed out. He did not need a third.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. A book that I'm sure will be peeking out from the top of many a Christmas stocking this year is the 20th anniversary edition of Nigella Lawson's How to Eat. A culinary classic, it's stuffed full of mouth-watering recipes that read like love letters to food, laced with a dash of Epicurean philosophy. And the icing on the cake is that How to Eat is now also a feast for the ears, with Nigella herself narrating the audiobook version.
The great culinary renaissance we hear so much about has done many things, given us extra virgin olive oil, better restaurants and gastro porn, but it hasn't taught us how to cook. Of course, standards have improved. Better ingredients are available to us now, and more people know about them. Food and cookery have become more than respectable. They are fashionable. But the renaissance of British cookery, as it was relentlessly tagged in the late 1980s, started in the restaurant and filtered its way into the home. This is the wrong way round.
I'm delighted to say that Nigella has joined me here in the studio. I'll have to admit that I was a little sceptical as to having an audio version of How to Eat because I've heard some pretty bad renditions of cookbooks in the past. But it was such a pleasant surprise because the conversational way that you write really does come through and brings the recipes to life. And as someone who can't actually read the paper copies of your cookbooks anymore, I was delighted to have it. Were you pleasantly surprised yourself?
Well, you know, I was. I mean, I went through various ranges of emotions doing it because it's quite odd, actually, speaking in a voice that you had when you were younger, a lot younger, of different, not a different person, but, you know, a different stage in your life, and yet you're doing it now. And that was odd. I really wanted to do it, but I did wonder how it would work. But when I started doing it, apart from, you know, that slight being in a slight time warp, which went away very quickly, and I felt quite immersed in it as I did it. I mean, it took a long time. It's a long book, and I'm not trained, so I did feel at some stage I had forgotten how to use my mouth and talk at some of it. But I did enjoy it, and actually, it reminded me as well about how much of cooking really is about having a conversation about food. And of course, there are certain recipes there that might be hard to follow, the baking ones, say, because you want to get weights and so forth. But so much of the rest of the cooking of the book is really, look, this is an idea. These flavours go well together. And I think it's quite, as you say, it's conversational and it's reflective. And I enjoyed feeling I was having that conversation actually out loud.
Absolutely. And I've been roasting chickens for the best part of 35 years now. But it was so nice to listen to your classic roast chicken recipe and just be reminded gently of all the things that I was meant to do, rather than have to look down a list of instructions and think, yes, it's exactly this amount and exactly that amount. It's learning through play. actually.
Exactly, exactly. And also, it's, and I think this is very much what I was trying to say in the book, one of the many things, as you know, it's a long book and I do a lot of talking, but also it's not just learning through play, it's actually saying, actually trust your instincts, because, you know, I might like a herb you don't like. That doesn't mean you can't do the recipe. And it really is about saying, cooking is about learning to trust your instincts, which means you have to repeat things a certain amount so you get the feel of the recipe. But then it's really, it's all over to you. And I think that's very important. And I think that the tyranny of the recipe can stop people from enjoying the playful side of cooking.
Yes, and there's no wrong way of doing it. It's just what's right for your taste and the taste that you're going to be
and,
serving up.
And, you know, you have to allow for failure because you have to take risks in cooking or in the rest of life. So that if a recipe doesn't work one day because you've decided you're going to add something you haven't added before to it and it doesn't work, you've learned a lesson there. And generally speaking, it just means maybe your supper's not quite as nice as you'd hoped, but it's not going to be disastrous.
You can salvage situations that you might otherwise...
Anything except for oversalting. That's my rule in life.
There's absolutely nothing you can do about it.
Well, if it's slightly oversalted, you can often add a bit of lemon juice or something because the sharpness kind of balances it. But generally, if it really is oversalted, that's it. You know, I think, and I've tried, and I like salty food, but I think that's probably it.
And it was a straight read from the original text. You didn't feel you had to change anything when you came back to it?
I changed some things, but I didn't, not in an editorial way. I think sometimes I had written sentences which I just ran out of breath reading, so I just truncated in that way. I left some remarks about where to find ingredients were slightly outdated, but I didn't actually change any of the words, even if... It did mean it really did still belong to 1998 and not 2018 or whatever, because in a way that's the book came out of that time, and I think to change its character would be wrong. So the rest of it was just like the normal sort of editing you have to do and changing something that people read on the page to reading through their ears in a way. So that was just... It just happened, and sometimes I found I changed things without meaning to as I read. But I try to keep it, respect the book it was. Which is odd when it's your own book, you know, because every now and then I'd say to the engineer, you know, the sound engineer, do you think I can change that? And he kept saying, it's your book.
When you originally wrote the book, did you type it out or did you dictate it? Because it does have that lovely...
Oh, I typed it out. I was a journalist from quite a young age, and not that young, but, you know, early 20s. And when I started writing, I always wrote longhand, and I got too emotional with it. I felt like it was a continuation of my bloodstream. So then I started typing, and after a while, I feel that although I do think when I talk, I actually start thinking a lot when my fingers are, you know, tip-tapping away, or not pretty badly, on a typewriter or a computer. And so I do feel that doesn't stop me being conversational. And I think it's a mixture. It's both conversational, but not as well. You know, writing in a way has to seem conversational, but I suppose you're allowed to play with language in a way that... you might not always if you were just talking.
And do you feel that much has changed in our attitude towards eating, cooking, food over the last 20 years?
Well, I think a lot has changed. I don't think I've changed an awful lot. And I mean, it amused me how many recipes are in the book that I feel like you could come across now. But not because I was being enormously prescient, but because, for example, I have a recipe for... some kale with chorizo and a poached egg. It's kind of hipster menu 101. But the thing is, then I wrote about it because I was lamenting that kale, or curly kale, I was brought up calling it curly kale, I was lamenting the fact that it had sort of fallen out of favour and you could never find it. So it was really writing about the food I had eaten and perhaps adding things that were a bit different. I think food was very polarised for various reasons, but I think... I'm glad to say there is still room for, I suppose, the greedy exploration of a home cook, and that's still possible now. And if anything, I think when I wrote the book, the world was so dominated by chefs. And I think in this country, at any rate, we've got quite a lot of home cooks who write about food and tell their stories. And I think storytelling is essential. And there seems to be more room for that now. So I think a lot of it's changed in a good way. I think faddishness never goes away. And if anything, it's become more extreme. But then whatever happens, there's always a reaction. There's room for so many different sorts of cooking.
Yes, and I mean, certainly you were the cook who gave me confidence to try what I thought might work or throw what I found in the back of the fridge into the pot and taste throughout my cooking and be confident just to run with how I felt.
I'm glad.
Yeah, and it's how I've taught my children to cook as well. And I think there's far more of that on TV than the rigid chemistry experiments that we sometimes have been subjected to. You're still writing new material as well?
Well, in theory, I've actually been on the road quite a lot this year. So I'm not actually writing something now, but I have something on the back burner.
Are there plans to make audio versions of Nigella Bites and the other books as well?
Well, not as far as I know. I suppose the publishers will wait and see what happens with the audio edition of How to Eat. How to Eat lends itself more. I think that possibly if I were thinking of other books, there would be Feast or Kitchen I would do before Nigella Bites, say, because I think, again, there's a more discursive elements within the book. There's more of a narrative voice.
Now, I know that your book is going to be peeking out of many a Christmas stocking. I think possibly my own daughter might be getting a copy. And coming on to Christmas, what are you planning for this Christmas? You've revolutionised the use of goose fat and prunes in Nigella's Christmas kitchen. Is there a secret ingredient this year?
Well, I not really. I'm actually quite traditional at Christmas. And, you know, I repeat very much this the familiar recipes. I think ritual is a very important part of human life, and Christmas is where it really, you know, remains. That I feel I have to have, you know, the turkey and so forth. And I'm ever since I started brining it those years back, I'm not going to change the way I do it. I might change the spices. I don't think so. I'm sticking pretty much to the traditional way of doing it, well, my traditional way of doing it. But of course, until I start cooking it this year, I won't know what I want to add. I always have to go off-piste a bit and, you know, add something extra at the last minute because that's how I cook. So I don't know. I'll know for next year.
Is your eye drawn to the unfamiliar vegetable or the forgotten vegetable as you walk through your local greengrocer and you think, oh, that might go nicely?
Well, yes, I actually did see some Brussels sprout tops the other day, which I do like. And I did think that would be rather a nice accompaniment as well to the Brussels sprouts. But I'm ready to have my head turned by something more ridiculous and flamboyant as well.
A lot of people who've lost their sight are rather scared of going into the kitchen. I wondered whether you have ever tried cooking with the lights off or in a blindfold?
Well, not, you know, I've had to cook in low light, but not, I haven't done it as an experiment. And I can see it would be frightening because you have knives and you have heat. But I think what you have to guide you, and what guides me a lot when I cook, is, you know, the smell, and actually something which is not talked about as much, but the sound. And I don't know if you find this, but I can often tell whether, if I'm not paying absolute attention to a pan, whether the onions have cooked a bit more, because the spluttering sound in the pan will change. And I can tell where things, I can tell by the sound of anything I stir in a pot before I even taste it, whether I think what stage of cooking it's got to. And I think, and certainly if you bake, you can tell a cake is ready because the smell is much more pronounced.
I'm so glad you said that, because actually I can tell when I take a chicken out of the oven, for instance, whether it's cooked through just by the way the fat is bubbling through it.
Yes.
And also by the smell.
Yes, but sound is so important when you cook, which is why I don't listen to music or anything when I cook, because you need the orchestra of the food, and that's beautiful, even before you take in how instructive it is.
And I think that's actually, again, one of the things that I like about your recipes. We aren't overburdened by having dozens and dozens and dozens of ingredients and not having to find a sighted person and say, is this tin the tomatoes or is it the coconut milk before you open it?
That must be hard. Is there any food that is braille in the packaging? In tin food and so forth, or not?
Not that I know of, but I'm not a braille user.
Right.
You can label things with barcodes,
yes.
Which a reader will read to you.
Right.
But having sighted wife and daughters, I tend just to shout across the kitchen. It's the only time I allow them into the kitchen, to be honest. So it's, yes, it's if there are only a dozen ingredients, then there are fewer things to muddle up,
yeah.
I think, and fewer things to knock over as well. You're also a very practical cook. It was you who reminded me that you can actually put a plastic bag of sauce into a plastic jug in the freezer and it won't it'll stand up straight and it won't leak all over the place. You were clearly brought up in a very sort of to hand way. If it's to hand, it's the best utensil to use.
And I also think that I'm often at my best sort of just living off my wits, so that if I have to think, how am I going to fit that in my deep freezer, I will think, well, that's, you know, that I have to put it in a jug because otherwise it will just ooze out flat and I haven't got that much room. So often it's just having to make those constant adjustments you do just to make things work. And it's about not knowing the right way to do things. And because I've never been, I mean, I grew up cooking, but I've never been taught it in any technical or professional sense. I don't know the right way to do it, so I cobble together a way that works for me.
And if you were to buy a utensil as a Christmas present for a friend, what would be your go-to utensil to buy?
Well, it's always considered hostile to give knives to people, but I'm very keen on a mezzaluna. When I did, I mean, I don't make kitchen stuff anymore, but when I did, I made one. And that's to say, it means half moon, and it's a curved knife. And I find very good being a clumsy person. It has two handles. Everyone thinks it looks sort of lethal and that you're going to cut yourself. But actually, you can't cut yourself very easily because you haven't got a hand there to cut. So I find that useful. And you can't really sort of run over things with it. Slightly, but I'm otherwise a stick blender. You know, those immersion blenders are good. So if you're making soup, you don't have to put it in something else. You just put the blender in the saucepan. I think those sorts of things are useful. But generally, I think with gadgets, we're keen on certain things we love, and that doesn't always mean someone else will love them as much. And as I say, I gave people mezzalunas for a long time, and a lot of people just always prefer to use knives. But I think anything that enables you to sort of be more hands-on with the food and it not being tricky to use, because a lot of gadgets, I think, are quite tricky to use. But otherwise, I don't know, I think this is a very boring present, but I think smaller chopping boards. I think a lot of chopping boards are far too big and when you're just doing a certain amount and they take up so much room on the counter. So I have chopping boards in all different sizes and I think that's a good present.
Yes, they're also easier to wash up as well.
Yes.
Do you do your own washing up? I've always wanted to know.
Well, not when I make the TV programmes, but otherwise, yes. I mean, I have a dishwasher, but, you know, everything goes in it. I don't mind washing up. What I really hate is putting things back. I don't know what that says about my character. It's, you know, I the washing up's fine, and I will leave things on the draining board, but I don't actually want to dry up.
And who's making Christmas lunch this year?
I'm making it with a friend of mine. We're getting together, so there's a group of us, and we have been apportioning tasks and, you know, foodstuffs. The difficulty is I'm worried that it was going to be rather too much. We've got two of us, you know. With saying, no, I'll do that. No, I want to do that. So I, a bit late because I've been in Australia, but I steamed my Christmas pudding yesterday and I will be making a huge ham. I've got a ham I cooked from a couple of books ago when really it's very easy. You just put it in a tray lined with foil, pour black treacle over it, close up the foil and cover it and just put it in a slow oven for a very, very long time. So I'm going to be crossing London with a very large hot ham on Christmas Day.
We will be thinking of you if you do so. So would you still hold to what you said a few years ago, which was Christmas is like the countryside, there's little to do but eat and drink?
I think that's true, but that's, I mean, I think that's true. I'm an urban person, so I don't think it's a slur on Christmas. It's a slight slur on the countryside. Perhaps I'm being one round more to rural life, but in small doses.
Well, I shall wish you a very, very happy urban Christmas and think of you driving across London with your ham. Nigella Lawson, thank you so much for coming into the RNIB Connect radio studios and for helping us celebrate Christmas.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Merry Christmas.
Cooking is best learnt at your own stove. You learn by watching and by doing. Chefs themselves know this. The great chefs of France and Italy learn about food at home. What they do later in the restaurants that make them famous is use what they've learnt. They build on it. They start elaborating. They take home cooking to the restaurant, not the restaurant school of cookery to the home. Inverting the process is like learning a vocabulary without any grammar. The analogy is pertinent. In years as a restaurant critic, I couldn't help noticing that however fine the menu, some chefs, for all that they seem to have mastered the idiom, have no authentic language of their own. We are at risk here of becoming a land of culinary mimics. There are some things you just cannot learn from a professional chef. I'm not talking of home economics, the rules that govern what food does when you apply heat or introduce air or whatever, but of home cooking and of how experience builds organically.
The 20th anniversary edition of How to Eat is out now in print, audio and ebook. A wide range of Nigella Lawson's books, including the original How to Eat, are available from the RNIB library in a full range of accessible formats. And I'm delighted to say that thanks to a special relationship between Penguin Random House and RNIB, Nigella's audiobook version of How to Eat will be joining them there soon. And Nigella will be back at the end of the show to serve up the books of her life. You're listening to a special Christmas edition of Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's compendium of the best in books and reading. Coming up later, Robert Kirkwood reviews G.R.R. Martin's Christmas Offerings. But first, just as there are songs written specially for Christmas, so there are Christmas books. And some writers specialise in writing them. Sue Moorcroft is a best-selling author of romantic fiction, with a huge following. Her latest novel, A Christmas Gift, has just entered the RNIB Talking Books Library. Georgine loves Christmas. The festive season always brings her little village of Middledip to life. But since her ex-boyfriend walked out, leaving her with enormous debts, she's been struggling to make ends meet. To keep her mind off her worries, she throws herself into organising the Christmas show at the local school. When handsome Joe Blackthorne becomes her assistant, Georgine is grateful for the help. But there's something about Joe she can't quite put her finger on. Georgine's past is about to catch up with her in ways she never expected. As the opening night of the show approaches, it promises to be a Christmas to remember. Sue Moorcroft, happy nearly Christmas.
And happy nearly Christmas to you too, Red.
So, what was the inspiration for A Christmas Gift?
So, why did I write A Christmas Gift? Somebody in my family who works with children, and some of them are neglected, and we were talking about neglected children in general, not about any specific child, obviously. And a little bell began to ring in the back of my head about somebody I was at school with. And I thought, oh, I think that's what was going on with him. And we were not such an enlightened society at the time. And everybody took the mickey out of this kid, including the teachers. They ought to be ashamed. I'm not ashamed to say it. And I started thinking about him. And I found out from a mutual school friend on Facebook that he's okay, he's doing okay. You know, I was really delighted. But it really began making me think about somebody with that background and how they can get over it and make good and everything. So that gave me Joe's starting point. I also, because I'm a bit of a story magnet, as soon as somebody tells me something, I store it away if it's any good. So watch what you tell me, just in case. But somebody told me a story about a company going bust. And it was all because somebody who didn't work in the company, but was the wife of, had too much to drink and was rude to the people who held the money on this big job. Very rude. And then refused to apologise once she was sober. And so they took this job away from the company and they went bust. 30-odd people lost their jobs. And so I decided that would be Georgine's setup. She's also got an ex-boyfriend who ran up debts while he was living at her address. So the debt collectors are coming to her house looking for him. She's helping her dad because he's got bad health. He's been having a lot of mini strokes one after the other and he's no longer able. And then her sister turns up on the doorstep having fallen out with her boyfriend again over money. So although she likes Christmas and she is the events director of a performing arts college and responsible for putting on this massive Christmas show, which I so enjoyed researching, it is a bit of a challenge for her this year.
And the book begins with Georgine literally running away from the debt collectors.
Yeah, she climbs over the back fence and runs away. Yeah, because she does run a bit for fun. So she decides to run to work that day and leaves them knocking at the front door on their own.
And I love that there is adversity for everybody at Christmas. It is as much a hard time as an enjoyable time for many people who are scrimping and saving. And yet it's also a time when people come together and pull together. And I suppose at the heart of A Christmas Gift is the story of the Christmas show Georgine is the events director for, and getting a bunch of fairly unruly kids who might otherwise not have a huge amount of focus together to produce something greater than the sum of its parts.
I find that kids who are into performing arts, as my kids were, do whatever else they do at school. They might bunk off maths, they might get in trouble for being in the field smoking when they're meant to be in English, but they'll go to their music and drama and dance lessons. And the same member of my family told me about this phenomenon. Now children have to stay in education till they're 18. I understand it's not policed very well, so some of them choose not to, but they should be in a job or in education or in an apprenticeship until they're 18 now. Well, not all kids are academic. And so what has happened is a lot of vocational further education colleges have sprung up. And this guy's friend at his school has implemented a girls' soccer academy in Northamptonshire in a town called Corby. And he just did it from nothing. He got the funding himself from the FA and from the Football Association, I mean, and from the local authority. But he's just had this idea and made it work. And so that was fresh in my mind as well. Oddly, this guy's name is JJ, and I'd already called my hero JJ for one of his identities, so that was all a bit of a coincidence. But this is how I came to bring this educational institution called Acting Instrumental into being. And I also researched institutions like Bowdoin's in North London, which, you know, is already doing it and doing it fantastically well.
You clearly did a huge amount of research about putting on a Christmas show.
It's, yeah.
I mean, I felt entertained just reading it. You're a very visual writer, and it was lovely following this show from its relatively unpromising start to its amazing finale. Do you thoroughly enjoy the research? Is that the thing that gets everything going for you?
It can be. It took me a little while, but I've now cottoned on to the fact that if I want to do something, I can write about it, and that gives me carte blanche. I'm going to Switzerland on Monday, and that's for next year's book. And I'm just going to go and watch processions and choirs and Christingles and a sledding competition, all this kind of stuff, so that I can send my characters to do the same thing. But yeah, I do love the research. Actually, I hit on my friends shamelessly for research. And I'm lucky to have one who is an actor and producer. So I hit him up for help and he used to meet me. And we would talk through all the things I needed to know about the show. And he completely got on board with it with me. I created a table, which is like, you know, how long each part would run and how many acts and scenes there are. Not that it ever showed up in the book, except just so you could allude to the right thing in the right tone of voice, in the right order. So if anybody is into Amdram, that it would feel correct. And I was fortunate as well to be at school with somebody who is a musician and singer. And she helped me. and introduced me to a drummer as well. Joe's a drummer. So Jack Savage of the indie pop band Friendly Fires helped me with that. And I'm constantly amazed how many people will, if you ask them, help you, or help me anyway.
In many ways, you're actually playing the part of Georgine in writing your book. You were putting the show together, you're putting the book together. Did you feel you were her whilst you were writing her parts?
I'm going to say no. Some people do say they feel like their central character, who's the same gender as them. I generally feel they're my best friend.
Right.
So my heroine is my best friend, and my hero is someone I could fall in love with. And doing what I do is great, because you can fall in love every 6 months. It never affects your marriage. It doesn't cost you a thing. It's very little effort. You don't. You can do anything you want, and you never have to explain yourself, except perhaps to the editor. Yeah, I thought what you were going to say was, had I put myself in Georgine's place to be Joe's, the real Joe, if you like, friend. And I was going to point out that no, although I was friendly-ish with the person at school who kicked all this off in my head, I won't pretend to have been his best friend and done something noble as Georgine did. We just weren't that friendly and I didn't know him that well. I do like my heroines to do something in which I feel an interest, because otherwise that lack of empathy is going to show, I believe.
And you always write in the third person as well, so clearly you want to distance yourself a bit.
I do like to have at least two points of view, the hero and the heroine. In some books, such as Just for the Holidays, somebody else, in that case it was a 13-year-old boy, had a viewpoint. In One Summer in Italy, an 18-year-old girl had, or woman I should say, had a viewpoint. It depends how that book comes to me. So I think I'm not super keen on the books that have lots of different characters taking the first person. So I think it's more to allow that revolving viewpoint. Not that everybody has the same viewpoint in one paragraph. I don't care for that either. There are clear scene breaks, which is more visual on the printed page than audio, I understand. We change heads. And that's the main reason I write third person. In my novels, I've written first person short stories quite frequently.
And you mentioned that you write two books a year, one for Christmas and one for the summer holidays.
That's right, yeah.
That's quite a work rate.
Yes, it is. I'm always pleased when people notice that. Yeah, that's a lot. It's a lot of work. And I do work 50 or 60 hours a week. Not all of those can be writing. I have to do promo. I'm always working on three books. So at the moment, I'm promoting A Christmas Gift. I've just finished the line edit, which is all the minutiae, on my May 2nd book, which is called A Summer to Remember. And I'll still have the proofing to do on that. And I'm writing my Christmas book for next year, which has been labouring under the title of Xmas Book 19. And I've moved on slightly from that. It's called A Christmas Adventure, just so my editor and I like to have a title to discuss, and then they'll tell me what it really is in due course.
And will it be characters from Middle Dip, as in A Christmas Gift again?
Yes, there are, actually. My summer book isn't. That's a brand new village on the North Norfolk coast where I've built a headland in the salt marshes, and I hope the residents there don't mind too much. I do move the scenery around quite a lot. I like to create a fictitious place that's near real places. So Middle Dip is northeast of Peterborough, where if you look on a map, there's a gap. So I populated it. And I have written quite a lot of books there because readers just seem to want me to. And if when I write in Italy or Malta or wherever, then people come back to me and say, when are you writing another Middle Dip book? So yes, the Christmas 19 book is set in Middle Dip. It's set mainly in the pub, the Three Fishes. But there's a lady called Lily who's come to work there. And she's come for a specific reason, not just to work in the pub. She's only working there as her second job. Her day job, if you like, is as an exhibitions designer. And so she's off to take people to Switzerland to do with this exhibition she's working on there. There's some crossover of characters who are have got relatives with jobs in Switzerland already. And she's taking like a mini choir out there to do a bit of a cultural tour of the area while they're there. And then she breaks her hand and she can't drive. And so the story begins.
And what is it about Christmas that gets your fingers flying across the keyboard?
Well, partly is that's what my publisher's asking me for. Well, my first Christmas book was The Christmas Promise, which did really well. So I had already written that and was partway through just for the holidays when my agent took me to Avon because they had had a writer central to their list who was writing Christmas Then Summer, and she'd just moved publishers. And so they were looking for somebody just like me. And it's taken me also into bestsellerdom in Germany because they like winter books. And now it's taking me into Canada. You know, there's an appetite for these. But my first decision to write a Christmas book was because I had a book that came out in October, I think, with my old publishers. And I was standing in a shop, supposedly doing a signing, and just watching all the Christmas books walk out of the store. And mine wasn't a Christmas book. And I thought, perhaps I ought to do one. And so I went and looked at news features rather than broadcasts and to find something that sort of got me going a bit, something I wanted to say something about. And it was revenge porn, where people, you know, when they're together, perhaps exchange saucy photos. And then when they're apart, one of them starts spreading those photos around, which I'm sure most right-thinking people know is just not cricket.
And this Christmas, will you be out in Switzerland still with the
snow? No, I'm going for 10 days. I think it's 2 days to drive each way. A writing friend of mine, Rosemary Kind, goes over frequently. And she said to me, if you want to set a book there, I'll take you. So I said, well, I'll set a book there. And then I was laughing and joking. And she carried on talking about it. And I said, are you serious? She said, oh, yeah. And I said, oh, OK, let me get on to my editor then.
And will you be listening to audiobooks along the way?
We will. We will. Yeah. Yeah. Rosemary is very much into audiobooks. So I think I've downloaded a Linda Howard one. She's an American writer who writes romantic suspense. And I've got a couple of Georgette Heyers from the library also on there. And I'm trying to think. Oh, it's a Jenny Colgan that Roz has downloaded. So we feel like, a book each way with a bit in hand. She makes this journey all the time and she's perfectly happy. We'll have a Swiss mountain dog in the car with us, Wilma. So, we're all set to go. I've been buying long underwear and bobble hats and ski gloves and snow boots and all this stuff. So if it doesn't bankrupt me, I'm going to really enjoy it.
And do you have much to do with the production of your own audiobooks or do you leave that to the publisher?
Yeah, that's the publisher's bag, definitely. When they choose an actor, they send me a clip. And say, are you happy? And occasionally I ask for another clip. For instance, if the clip they send me is first person, I'd like to hear how she handles third person or how she handles the male voice. Then I ask for that. But otherwise, I tend to go with their recommendation because the audio manager must have, you know, such a depth and breadth of experience in this.
And I know you have a street team of people who you go out to. Are any of them blind or partially sighted? And do any of them feedback on how the audiobooks sound to them?
I do get feedback on audiobooks in the normal way of things because people just talk to you on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I don't, as far as I know, have a partially sighted or blind reader in the street team. I have quite a lot of book bloggers and some other writers and some friends and some readers. My grandfather was, but he wouldn't have listened to my book. If it wasn't a whodunit, he didn't like it. He did used to read my magazine stories with his magnifying glass, but he wasn't always partially sighted. He lived to a great age and he got macular degeneration and cataracts and a spontaneously detaching retina. I'm very careful and, you know, very grateful for my sight. And, I'm kind of aware that audiobooks can mean so much to different people. For me, they're something to listen to when I'm out walking or driving or making the dinner or whatever. But to other people, they're a lifeline. And I can imagine if I was ever affected like that, I would be so grateful.
Well, it has been a Christmas gift listening to your latest novel.
Thank you.
They're brilliantly narrated and I'm very much looking forward to next Christmas's book already.
Well, thank you very much, Red. It's been my pleasure.
Georgine tied the laces of her running shoes, keeping one anxious eye in the patterned glass in her front door and the two manly shapes silhouetted by November sunlight. One of them knocked with measured movements. Miss France? Miss France, come to the door, please. Then he muttered something to his companion. The companion answered clearly, not given up yet, and leant on the doorbell, raising his voice above the sound. If you could just open the door, Miss France, we won't keep you long. Everything about the men and their insistence said debt collectors. Even though she knew they weren't as bad as bailiffs, who could lawfully gain entry, they raised too many horrible memories for her to open the door, even just to say that Aidan no longer lived with her. She wouldn't have expected to be believed, anyway.
Una Byrne narrating A Christmas Gift, written by my guest today, Sue Moorcroft. It's TB 703655. Sue Moorcroft's A Christmas Gift, along with many of her other books, is available from the RNIB Library. For more information, visit the website rniblibrary.org or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Now, before we sample the treat that Nigella Lawson has selected as the books of her life,
have a listen to this.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
They've found her, my lord! Ned rose quickly. Her men or Lannisters? It was Jory. Daenerys Targaryen wed Khal Drogo with fear and barbaric splendour in a field beyond the walls of Pentos. The North went on forever. Tyrion Lannister knew the maps as well as anyone. But a fortnight on the wild track that passed for the King's Road up here had brought home the lesson that the map was one thing and the land quite another.
Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. Book 1 in A Song of Ice and Fire.
The courtyard rang to the sound of swords. Under black wool, boiled leather and mail, sweat trickled icily down John's chest as he pressed the attack.
Narrated by Tom Carter, it lasts 35 hours and 2 minutes. Talking book number 19231.
Tell Jory to bring her here at once. I am sorry, my lord, Poole told him. The guards on the gate were Lannister men, and they informed the queen when Jory brought her in. She's been taken directly before the king.
Also available are A Clash of Kings, A Storm of Swords, A Feast for Crows, and A Dance with Dragons. And many of them you can buy as a Daisy CD. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
In addition to the 5 existing A Song of Ice and Fire books that inspired the TV series Game of Thrones, RNIB Library also has this.
The long reign of King Aegon I Targaryen, 1 AC to 37 AC, was by and large a peaceful one, in his later years especially. But before the Dragon's Peace, as the last 2 decades of his kingship were later called by the Maesters of the Citadel, came the Dragon's Wars, the last of which was as cruel and bloody a conflict as any ever fought in Westeros.
Fire and Blood, 300 years before A Game of Thrones, by George R.R. Martin. Set 300 years before the events in A Song of Ice and Fire, Fire and Blood is the definitive history of the Targaryens in Westeros. It begins their tale with the legendary Aegon the Conqueror, creator of the Iron Throne, and goes on to recount the generations of Targaryens who fought to hold that iconic seat, all the way up to the civil war that nearly tore their dynasty apart.
Though the Wars of Conquest were said to have ended when Aegon was crowned and anointed by the High Septon in the Starry Sept of Old Town, not all of Westeros had yet submitted to his rule. In the Bight, the Lords of the Three Sisters had taken advantage of the chaos of Aegon's conquest to declare themselves a free nation and crown Lady Marla of House Sunderland their queen. As the Arryn fleet had largely been destroyed during the conquest, the king commanded his Warden of the North, Torrhen Stark of Winterfell, to end the Sistermen's rebellion, and a northern army departed from White Harbour on a fleet of hired Bravo Sea galleys under the command of Sir Warwick Manderly. The sight of his sails, and the sudden appearance of Queen Visenya and Vhagar in the skies above Sisterton, took the heart out of the Sistermen.
What really happened during the Dance of the Dragons? Why was it so deadly to visit Valyria after the Doom? What were Major the Cruel's worst crimes? And what was it like in Westeros when dragons ruled the sky? Fire and Blood, 300 years before A Game of Thrones, is read by Simon Vance, and it lasts 26 hours and 24 minutes. And you will feel every one of those minutes, as this reads more of a textbook than as a Game of Thrones adventure. It is a very dense history, and can be a bit confusing, as more than one Targaryen is called Aegon. But if you're a Game of Thrones fan, Fire and Blood is talking book number 703684. Also in the library, you'll find The World of Ice and Fire, The Untold History of Westeros, and The Game of Thrones.
There are none who can say with certain knowledge when the world began. Yet this has not stopped many maesters and learned men from seeking the answer. Is it 40,000 years old, as some hold, or perhaps a number as large as 500,000, or even more? It is not written in any book that we know, for in the first age of the world, the Dawn Age, men were not lettered. We can be certain that the world was far more primitive, however, a barbarous place of tribes living directly from the land with no knowledge of the working of metal or the taming of beasts. What little is known to us of those days is contained in the oldest of texts.
George R.R. Martin, in collaboration with Elio M. Garcia Jr. and Linda Antoson, has written a comprehensive history of the Seven Kingdoms, featuring the epic battles, bitter rivalries, and daring rebellions that lead up to the events in the Song of Ice and Fire series.
With the destruction of the Rhoynar, Valyria soon achieved complete domination of the western half of Essos, from the Narrow Sea to Slaver's Bay, and from the Summer Sea to the Shivering Sea. Slaves poured into the freehold and were quickly dispatched beneath the 14 flames to mine the precious gold and silver the freeholders loved so well.
Collected within this volume is the accumulated knowledge, scholarly speculation, and inherited folk tales of maesters and septons, magi and singers, family trees for the houses Stark, Lannister, and Targaryen, and in-depth explanations of the history and culture of Westeros.
Outside the smoking ruins of Harrenhal, King Aegon accepted an oath of fealty from Edmund Tully, Lord of Riverrun, and named him Lord Paramount of the Trident. The other river lords did homage as well, to Aegon as king and to Edmund Tully as their liege lord. When the ashes had cooled enough to allow men to enter the castle safely, the swords of the fallen, many shattered or melted or twisted into ribbons of steel by dragonfire, were gathered up and sent back to the Aegon fort in wagons.
Again, a book for the real fans of Game of Thrones. It's read by Roy Dotrice and Nicholas Guy Smith. It runs for 21 hours, 23 minutes, and it's talking book number 700189.
Now it's back to Nigella Lawson to share the books of her life. Nigella, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, I read so much as a child. I mean, I never stopped. I don't know that I'd say one particular book, but I think if I think now about the books of my childhood, the one that I return to still now, but certainly read so much as a child, is Little Women. And it's an extraordinary book that it still seems to exert so much influence or attraction to people. You know, it exerts this power because, you know, they're constantly making remakes of films and television series, but actually it's reading the book. Now, of course, when I read the book now, there's a lot in it. There is a lot in Little Women that drives me absolutely mad. And yet I think it is so much a part of me. I mean, I think all... When you're growing up as a girl, you know, all girls do at some stage identify with one of the characters. It's nearly always Joe, but I'm always fascinated when I meet women to know which character, you know, they identified with. And it can be quite telling.
I shall have a new ribbon for my hair, and Mommy will lend me her little pearl pin. And my new slippers are lovely, and my gloves will do, though they aren't as nice as I'd like. Mine are spoilt with lemonade, and I can't get any new ones, so I shall have to go without, said Jo, who never troubled herself much about dress. You must have gloves, or I won't go, said Meg decidedly. Gloves are more important than anything else. You can't dance without them. And if you don't, I should be so mortified. Then I'll stay still. I don't much care for company dancing. It's no fun to go sailing round. I like to fly about and cut capers. You can't ask Mother for new ones. They're so expensive, and you are so careless. She said when you spoilt the others that she shouldn't get you any more this winter. Can't you make them do? Asked Meg anxiously.
Little Women by Louisa May Alcott is available from the library in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB21665, narrated by Liza Ross. And is there a book that on a cold and rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread as comfort food?
I think that would have to be David Copperfield. I think it's an extraordinary novel. It's absolutely a very true story of someone becoming a person. And it doesn't surprise me that it was Freud's favourite novel. I've reread it at regular intervals, and I always find something new there. And it's tremendously sad and tremendously funny. I think that anyone who hasn't read David Copperfield is in for such a treat. I'm almost unbearably envious of someone reading it for the first time.
Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I record that I was born, as I have been informed and believe, on a Friday at 12 o'clock at night. It was remarked that the clock began to strike and I began to cry simultaneously. In consideration of the day and hour of my birth, it was declared by the nurse and by some sage women in the neighbourhood who had taken a lively interest in me several months before there was any possibility of our becoming personally acquainted, first, that I was destined to be unlucky in life, and secondly, that I was privileged to see ghosts and spirits, both these gifts inevitably attaching, as they believe, to all unlucky infants of either gender born towards the small hours on a Friday night. I need say nothing here on the first head, because nothing can show better than my history whether that prediction was verified or falsified by the result. On the second branch of the question, I will only remark that unless I ran through that part of my inheritance while I was still a baby, I have not come into it yet. But I do not at all complain of having been kept out of this property. And if anybody else should be in the present enjoyment of it, he is heartily welcome to keep it.
David Copperfield, written by Charles Dickens and narrated by Nigel Carrington, is TB14499. It's also available in Braille and giant print. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'll be sharing with others for Christmas?
Well, it's not a recent book, but I read it fairly recently, maybe last year, and it's a book I can't stop giving to people. I give it to people compulsively. It's The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert. And I feel that this is a book that has not been given the credit that it should have. And I think that's because a lot of people are quite snobbish. Her big hit was Eat, Pray, Love, and people feel they judge in advance what kind of a book they think it's going to be. And The Signature of All Things is the most astonishing story, hugely ambitious, so extraordinarily evocative. You travel to places just through the words enormously. You learn about things. Who knew that you could read a book and become intrigued by mosses? It's a story of difficulty of being in the world and loneliness, but also how much there is in the world and what beauty there is to feed on. And it's an extraordinary book, and I give it to a lot of people. I'm very excited always to hear what they thought of it. And, you know, when you give a book, you know that will last in someone. I think in literary criticism terms, it has residue. That's the biggest present you can give.
Henry Whittaker was born in 1760 in the village of Richmond, just up the Thames from London. He was the youngest son of poor parents, who had a few too many children already. He was raised in two small rooms, with a floor of beaten earth, with an almost adequate roof, with a meal on the hearth nearly every day, with a mother who did not drink, and a father who did not beat his family. By comparison to many families of the day, in other words, a nearly genteel existence. His mother even had a private spot of dirt behind the house in which to grow larkspurs and lupines, decoratively, like a lady. But Henry was not fooled by larkspurs and lupines. He grew up sleeping one wall away from the pigs, and there was not a moment in his life when poverty did not humiliate him.
The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert is available commercially in print and ebook, and as an audiobook narrated by Juliet Stevenson. Well, Nigella Lawson, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on RNIB Connect Radio. Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my special Christmas guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm at redsail, which is REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, from Robert and me, farewell until next year. Have a very Merry Christmas and remember to read on.